We have long since talked about different stories on this program that deal with conspiracies, the unknown. Tonight, a story that will get you to just shake your head. Crisis by Design, the untold story of the global financial coup with John Truman Wolf. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Let me tell you a little bit about John Truman Wolf, our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Former chairman of the Department of History at John F. Kennedy University, he has worked with federal law enforcement agencies and through them, intelligence services of foreign governments. John is also the author of what we're talking about tonight, Crisis by Design, the untold story of the global financial coup. It's an incredible story. John, welcome to Coast, my friend. How are you?
George, I'm terrific. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, Michael, what a story. I mean, riveting. How did you come across this?
Well, I've been following the international bankers for some time, George. I was a banker up in the San Francisco area many years ago and took an interest in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and their shenanigans, to put it lightly, to call what they do lightly, and followed them for some years. When the financial crisis started to roll out, I noticed an article in the Wall Street Journal by the then president of the New York Fed where that person was calling for a global monetary authority, a GMA. I'd never heard that term before, or those initials before, and I started looking into it. And GMA stands for Global Monetary Authority, which is essentially, George, a financial dictator for the planet.
Exactly.
For those of your listeners that don't follow such things, the then president of the New York Fed, we're talking about March of 2008, was none other than Timothy Geithner.
Mm-hmm.
So I started researching and writing. I wrote an article predicting that there would be a global monetary authority. And shortly after I finished the first article, indeed, that was put in place. Most people don't have a clue that this was done. But in April of 2009, at the G20 meeting in London, an entity was created, George, called the Financial Stability Board, the FSB. This entity is housed in the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland.
And what is that, the Bank for International Settlements?
It's a very good question. This is a kind of been a hidden entity. The Bank for International Settlements is the central banker's central bank. So the members of the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, include the Federal Reserve Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Italy, the Bank of Japan. All 55 central banks, major central banks on the planet, are members of and junior to, George, the Bank for International Settlements. This is truly the behind-the-scenes kingmaker, if you will.
It's the mother of all banks, isn't it?
This is the baby. And interestingly, they're similar to the Vatican in that their land is inviolate. Swiss law does not apply to them. Their employees are immune from Swiss law. They have their own military or police force. They're above the law entirely, George.
And I bet they're getting bigger, John.
They are getting bigger. They're getting bigger as these crises that they help create draw the attention or the fear, I should say, of others that an international solution is needed. They're it. The Financial Stability Board is it.
This push for this global currency, is it the dollar that they wanted or something else?
Is it the dollar that I'm not sure I understand.
When they want this global currency?
Yes.
Did they want the dollar to be that currency?
No.
Or, okay.
No. Indeed, the financial crisis had a very specific and has a very specific purpose. That purpose is to take down the United States and the United States dollar as the stable datum in international finance and to replace them with this global monetary authority. The global currency that is being rolled out, and a lot of people talk about the Amero and so forth. My personal opinion is the Amero is a red herring. The global currency that is being rolled out as we speak is the SDR. The SDR is the currency of the International Monetary Fund. It is a fiat currency of the IMF. SDR stands for Special Drawing Rights. It's just a name. And that's the global currency that is being pushed into central banks to replace dollars.
Fiat currency meaning really nothing behind it,
that's
right?
That's exactly correct. A fiat currency is something declared by fiat or order. So a government goes, good, you know, the dollar is acceptable for the payment of debts by this fiat. It's a currency. But you're right. There's nothing behind it. No precious metals, no production, no products. It's just exists by dictation.
Why can... Guys, there's so much I want to talk with you about tonight, John, but why can some countries, like the United States, have fiat currency, nothing backing it, and make and print as much as they want, and appear to be wealthy, and in other countries who are, third-stricken nations, who are drop-dead poor, they can't make their own money and say the same thing. Why can't they and we can?
Well, they can and do make their own money. Here's the difference. As you know, I'm sure, and probably many of your listeners remember or have at least read about, our currency was backed by gold up until 1971. Foreign governments or foreign central banks could turn in dollars to the Federal Reserve Bank, and they could get gold in return. As we started spending during the Vietnam War, huge amounts of dollars going out, and we were printing, Charles de Gaulle, kept turning in dollars asking for gold. And finally, in 1971, Nixon put his foot down and closed the gold window. So he just went, no more of this. We aren't going to exchange gold for dollars. What occurred after that, however, to keep the dollar propped up, which is really your question, why is the dollar continued to be the world reserve currency?
When there's nothing to back it up.
There's nothing to back it up except for the fact that it was mandated that oil has to be bought and sold in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so as oil is the energy of planet Earth currently, that gets traded all over the planet. And these transactions had to be in dollars, and that kept the dollar up, and it kept the dollar afloat, and it kept the dollar strong. Now, that said, as drastic as this economy is falling, certainly during the 70s and 80s, American prosperity, while it was slowly ebbing, was still extremely strong. We're still the largest economy on the planet.
Oh, sure. Those who are working, John, are doing relatively well. They're paying their bills. They're paying their mortgages. The problem is more and more people aren't working.
Well, that's right. I mean, unemployment and the government figures I don't trust, and one can, do a little research and find out that the figures that they're using are altered. But we're experiencing, as we speak, dramatic unemployment, and it's going to get worse. As you can see or probably read in the paper, the president's pushing for another kind of mini bailout of another $50 to $80 billion. It's outrageous, George. We stand here today with the U.S. budget deficit this year at $1.8 trillion. These are mind-numbing figures.
They are.
If you spent $1 million a day since the time of Christ, you would not have $1 trillion.
Unbelievable. Now, these bankers, part of the Bank for International Settlements, also include those who want to crush our economy. They include Americans, don't they?
Yes, they do.
So wouldn't that be treason?
You're not going to get any argument from me on that. Greenspan was a member. Now Bernanke's a member. Geithner's a member. It's outrageously treasonous. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that the fiscal autonomy of the United States has been dished off to a bunch of bankers in Basel, Switzerland, and people don't know.
Most people aren't. People are just finding out, other than those who've listened to this program, John, that the Federal Reserve is not part of government.
Exactly.
And I mean, the fact that they could do this and no one know about it, it was very easy for them. They probably figured out most humans on this planet aren't going to get involved with the financial aspects of life. All they want to know is that is there money in their bank account, and we'll do whatever we want.
Well, it's a very smoke and mirror scene. The subject of economics has been made extremely complex and confusing with a lot of words. I don't know if you ever listened to Greenspan or even Bernanke testify before Congress. It's a joke, George.
Very arrogant. Very arrogant.
It's not only the arrogance. There is arrogance. You're absolutely right. But they sit and spew this economic psychobabble, and these legislators sit there kind of with their mouths open, and they don't understand a word. And the reason they don't understand a word is because most of those pronunciations are just hot air. There's no sound economics there. I repeat, a trillion and a half budget deficit this year. That means we're spending that much more than we take in. The government does their financial planning backwards. They go, okay, good. How much are we going to spend this year? $4 trillion. Okay. What's our income? $2.2 trillion. Oh, we're a little short. So they have to go cap in hand and borrow the difference. And that's what treasury bills and treasury bonds are. They are IOUs, which the U.S. government sells to our friends at the Chinese Communist Party.
Jeez. We'll get into that, too. Okay, you call your book Crisis by Design.
Yes.
And you say the financial crisis was a planned event. Let's get into that. When did they plan this?
Well, this story starts back in the 80s with Greenspan's ascension to the Fed. And it's interesting because for those of you that followed such things, or for those of your listeners that followed such things, the major banks on the planet in the 80s were the Japanese banks. And you may remember, you know, the Japanese over here buying up, Pebble Beach and
yeah.
Beverly Hills and et cetera, et cetera. And the reason that the Japanese banks were so big and so powerful, because six of the top banks on the planet at that time were Japanese banks. It's because the capital requirements of Japanese banks were very low. If your capital is basically your reserves, and it determines how much you can lend. So if your capital requirements are low, you can lend more. If you can lend more, you get more interest, you get more income, more profit, and you're stronger. When Greenspan came to power, he got together with the then head of the Bank of England, whose name escapes me right this second. But and those two went, hey, we can't have this. And they basically called the Japanese to a meeting in Basel, Switzerland, at the Bank for International Settlements. And they said, look, Japanese bankers, if you want to continue to have access to Western markets, meaning Western Europe and the United States, you're going to have to set your capital requirements higher, to say 8%. At the time, the Japanese banks were operating at about 3%. Well, one, the Japanese didn't have too much of a choice on the one hand. On the other hand, capital is determined to a large degree on how stock goes. If your stock or your bank goes up, your capital goes up. And at that time, the Nikkei Dow was soaring. So they went, okay, they made an agreement. That agreement is referred to as Basel I. It was Basel I, and the book gets into Basel I and Basel II and what those agreements did. But essentially, that agreement slammed in capital requirements on Japanese banks. Shortly thereafter, interestingly, the Japanese stock market crashed, and Japanese banks went into a tailspin, and the Japanese economy went into a tailspin from which it never recovered. Now, in addition to setting the capital requirements, they also said, okay, good, bank capital requirements have to be 8%, except if you're lending on real estate. If you're lending on real estate, the capital requirements are only half. Your reserves only have to be half. And that, George, started the rush to real estate lending that went on through the late 80s, the 90s, into the 21st century. And
everything was getting financed then.
Everything was getting financed. But those, the Basel I set the tone because it gave banks an incentive to make real estate loans. And then there's more to the story, but that was kind of the foundation.
Okay. Why did they plan the financial crisis? What did they want to do besides, when you say bring us down, What do you mean by bring us down?
Well, I mean reduce us economically, which is exactly what's going on, George, and to remove the dollar as the world's reserve currency. They wanted to control and are gaining control. This isn't, you know, people talk about conspiracy theories. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is happening. People can Google Financial Stability Board and the Bank for International Settlements, and they can see what I'm talking about. But they wanted to have control of international, international monetary control. And so as the dollar has become less valuable, as the euro has become less valuable, they are pushing an international currency that they can control.
Are these globalists? They want this one world government?
Yes, indeed.
And in order to do a one world government, you have to have a single economy, don't you?
You have to have a single currency, George. And if you can dictate the policies of the central banks, for your listeners that don't follow such things, central banks create monetary policy in their countries. They create the amount of money in circulation.
Right. Not the governments.
So if those orders or directions are coming from the Bank for International Settlements and by way of directive to the Fed, to the Bank of England or whatever, they can control the currencies of the planet as they see fit. And that's what they want. And that is a global government.
Now, the members of the Bank for International Settlements, are there also people there that we wouldn't even know who they are? They're so big.
Well, it's not that it's so big. These people haven't been players on the world stage particularly.
Are they wealthy, though?
Some are wealthy. Some are not wealthy. I mean, it's kind of a little bit of a relative term. I mean, these are not all Rockefellers and Rothschilds, although they're running with that crowd.
Okay, but there's no way the Rothschilds would let someone be subservient to them.
That's correct.
And run with the ball.
That's
unless
true.
They said, this is my ball game.
Unless they blessed it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely correct. So you've got a cabal, a true cabal of elite globalists. I hate kind of throwing those terms around.
Well, we talk about, they're going to know what you're talking about in this program.
But that's exactly what's there, George. And they have got their claws sunk in now to the central banks of this planet. And I have been watching. They're starting to issue directives now to the central banks. They're worded in a very subjective manner.
Right.
But clearly these orders are coming from Basel, from the Financial Stability Board. It's very interesting, George, that in 2006, right before the financial crisis started, and it kind of had its birth, at least in the press, in 2007, two people left the helm of Goldman Sachs. One was the CEO, which folks in this country know, Henry Paulson. He came from Wall Street, from Goldman Sachs. The chairman, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, came to government, became the Secretary of Treasury. He's the one that jammed the first stimulus package down the throats of Congress. The other person, George, and this kind of addresses the point that you're making that people wouldn't know, was a guy named Mario Draghi, D-R-A-G-H-I, Mario Draghi.
All right, hold on to that. Yeah. We'll find out about Mario Draghi, whoever he is, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, John, who is Mario Draghi?
Mario Draghi, or Draghi, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it's D-R-A-G-H-R. He was an executive with Goldman Sachs. And about the time that Henry Paulson left the CEO-ship of Goldman and came to Washington, D.C., Draghi left Goldman's executive ranks as well. And he went back to Italy and became the head of the Central Bank of Italy, just like the Fed here. But then what he did, George, is he became the chairman of the Financial Stability Board, this kind of secretive group inside the Bank for International Settlements that is overseeing the central banks of planet Earth. So I just found it fascinating that these two Goldman executives, and there's a chapter on Goldman in the book, left the top of Goldman's ranks and wound up being key players in the financial crisis.
Why would they give up Goldman Sachs, which probably was paying them 10 times the amount of money they made going over to this financial stability board?
Well, exactly. I mean, that question almost answers itself. Why indeed would they do that? Why would Henry Paulson leave, hundreds of millions? I mean, I think his fortune was $632 million. He didn't leave that, but his, you know, the annual bonuses that those guys
get there
to pay off a third world debt, you know. The same for Draghi. I just found it, and I haven't had time to research and write further, other than, as I say, there's a chapter on Goldman Sachs and all their players placed around the planet. But clearly, in my opinion, there's something more to this than their good humanitarian purposes to come and help the U.S. government. Help the U.S. government. The trillion-dollar bailout went to the banks. That money went from your and my W-2 to the banks on Wall Street. Paulson
sure did
nothing but rout hundreds of billions of dollars to banks on Wall Street, and Draghi becomes the head of this kind of secretive organization in Basel, Switzerland, controlling the central banks.
And it appears that it's just gone from one administration to the next. I mean, I don't see a change.
Well, there isn't a change. When you the folks take a look at the chapter on Goldman Sachs in there, and there's actually a diagram, and you can roll this thing back to the Clinton administration and see Robert Rubin, who was the co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. He was into the White House, and then he became Secretary of Treasury. This rolled on through the Bush administration. I named several people that were in the White House under Bush from Goldman Sachs. Josh Bolton, his chief of staff, was from Goldman, George Bush's. And we stand here today with the Obama administration. Larry Summers is an acolyte of Robert Rubin. Geithner is also an acolyte of Rubin. And so you've basically got, government by Goldman Sachs. Wall Street is running this country, George.
I'm going to ask you a several-fold question here.
Okay.
As we get into this. If you're 25 years old today and you're hearing this kind of information, you've graduated from college, maybe you got a job in your degreed field and you're making $20,000 or $25,000 a year. I was always told if you can make how old you are, you're doing okay. What do you do, John? Someone's listening to the program right now. He or she is 25 years old. What do? Do they say, oh, my gosh, what's happening? Or do they just keep plodding along, 25 years old?
Well, I think there are two things that they do, George. One is to be fiscally prudent. I've got a chapter on solutions in terms of personal investments and those kinds of things, and I have recommendations in the books in the book in terms of what people should do in that regard. So, and I'm not necessarily going to get into those in detail unless you like. But
we'll get into that.
Okay. So one is to is to act prudently financially. The other thing is to step out and make your voice heard. And the book also has very specific suggested solutions to how we handle this. And two things have to happen, George. One is that the United States Congress has got to wake up and get responsible, because this agreement that got signed at the G20 meeting in London a year ago, April, needs congressional approval. The president can't just go dish off our financial authority without Congress taking a look at it. Either the Senate has got to approve it as a treaty per the Constitution, or there's an agreement one step down from that called a congressional executive agreement. And they have to, one, bless what the president signed, but much more than that, not just bless it. There needs to be oversight and checks and balances over these bankers. We cannot have bankers running our lives, because these guys are vampirish in their greed. So people need to – this is still a democracy. And I've done work in Washington, and I have seen how calls and faxes and emails can get legislators to move, although these days It's not surprising that people get a little apathetic about that. But that said, you've got a lot of people in Congress these days that are waking up and very concerned about the awakening of the American electorate. If there's one positive development in this administration, it's the fact that the American public is waking up from apathy and getting angry and doing some things. So one, contact your representatives, your congressman, congresswoman, and your senators, and make it very clear that they need to wake up and be responsible and become aware of the fact that the financial sovereignty of this country has, in fact, been dished off to the Bank for International Settlements. That information's in the book, or they can go to the Bank for International Settlements and read it themselves. The second thing that needs to be done, George, and this is a longer range view of it, We need to have financial reform. We've got to have it so that these currencies aren't being manipulated. And we can do that if we back currency not by gold, because gold can be manipulated and there isn't enough of it, but by actual production, by products and real estate. If money represents products, you can't have deflation and inflation and deflation. If you allocate money based on the amount of production in a state or a country, then the amount of money is available to buy the products and services that are there to buy. So the long-winded answer to your question is there are specific investment things that a young man or woman should do today that's 25. And two, we can't just turn our back on the fact that we've got a global financial crisis and these international bankers are running roughshod. We've got to be responsible about it.
Absolutely. Ron Paul may be the only politician who has a view of this entire scenario. Would you agree?
I would say Ron Paul in the House and Tom Coburn in the Senate.
Okay. The Federal Reserve, how strong is it? You know, it's an underling to the Bank for International Settlements, but I'm sure it's a big player.
Yes, it's an extremely big player, and how strong is it was demonstrated by the fact that Ron Paul's bill got through the House. He muscled it through the House.
He did muscle it, that's right.
As it was written, and then it got to the Senate, and Chris Dodd and his committee chopped it up and just weakened it dramatically, so that the bill to audit the Fed, which is quite simple, all Dr. Paul was asking for was an audit of the Fed. They're screaming that this would affect financial fiscal policy and so forth, was just a red herring, George. But they chopped this thing up and they said, okay, good, well, there's going to be an audit of what the Fed did during the financial crisis. The truth of the matter is that the United States government should take back the printing of money from this group of, to use this metaphor again, fiscal vampires at the Federal Reserve Bank.
John, what do the globalists want? I mean, they've got more money than God. They've got the power they need. I mean, what do they want? Are they bored with life? Is this like a chess game for them?
Well, they do have more money than most people could even imagine. They do have power.
Who needs that amount of money?
Exactly. Except they don't think that way, George. They don't think that way. They think like we need to keep – they're afraid that there's going to be some kind of revolution. They're afraid of anyone that will do good. They're afraid of people finding out the crimes that they have committed. These people are psychotic, to use a word.
They are petrified. This is my impression, John. They are petrified of the truck driver out there listening to this program going, right on, I'm not going to let them do this to me. They're petrified of the police officer who says, you know what, I've been pushed enough, it's not going to happen. They're petrified of the fact that we're talking about this right now, aren't they?
They are. They are indeed, and that's why you see efforts to control the internet by the federal government and suppression on communication. They are petrified. That's the perfect word. They are in fear. And so the logical, reasonable look at these people and say, you've got all the money and power that you need. What's your problem? Their problem is that they are petrified, and they are petrified that people will take back control of their government. And I speak in this country not only from someone who currently has their eye on what's going on in Washington and follows it closely, but as you said during my introduction, the former chairman of the Department of History of a small private college in Northern California. I love this country, George. Most Americans love this country. And what is going on now is outrageous. I hate to keep harping on this number, but it drives home a point. $1.8 trillion budget deficit this year. Last year it was $1.4 trillion. This cannot continue. It is unsustainable. And people have to take back control of the government and get people in there like Dr. Paul, as you mentioned, and like Tom Coburn in the Senate, who is the most fiscally conservative senator on the Hill, and bring some sanity back to government.
Where does the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund fit into this?
Good question. These institutions were formed after the Second World War, or towards the end of the Second World War, actually, at Brenton Woods, New Hampshire, in 1944, where the Allies got together and made agreements that restructured or structured the world financial architecture. The World Bank was originally supposed to make loans to European nations that had been devastated, and the International Monetary Fund was supposed to keep a balance in currency exchange. But they have grown way, way beyond these original intentions. Here's what they do, George, and here's how they act. They take a guy like George Soros, who is an ally of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. For those folks that don't know, George Soros is a currency trader. He's a billionaire. Soros will go short sell a currency of a third world country. By short selling is a process by which
he thinks it's going to go down in value.
That's right. That's right. And I watched him do this in the Far East about a decade ago, and that was a pilot for what's going on now. I consider that a pilot. So they crash the currency. Then the economy goes haywire. There are riots. There's civil commotion because the currency has crashed. Exports fall. People can't get jobs. And then here comes the IMF and the World Bank riding in on white horses. These are sister organizations, George. They march arm in arm. And they come in to, let's say, Indonesia, which is what happened in 1998. And they say to the premier or the president, gee, you got a problem? How would $5 or $10 billion suit you? And the premier or president, in some cases, they go, no. So the riots continue. In some cases, they go, absolutely. And they take their $10 billion, they take a billion themselves, stick it in their Swiss bank account.
And they're all set.
I'm sorry?
They're all set. They don't care.
And then they sign a loan agreement, George. And I have read these loan agreements, and they are appalling. It gives the IMF and the World Bank the authority to control tax policy, education policy, population control.
They basically signed over their country to
that's
them.
Exactly right. So that's what these guys have been doing for the last few decades. And most of this planet, most of the third world countries on this planet are beholden and in debt to these international bankers, these financial organizations, and this scene that's going on now, that happened in the United States last year, and that's going on in Europe now, is the final act in this play.
They seem to be acting with an urgency.
I agree with you. I agree with you, because I've been following them for some time, and they've kind of been plodding along, and I've written some articles about it, just kind of so-so. Now it has moved up. The tempo has increased dramatically.
Where does war fit into this equation?
Well, war fits into the equation to keep countries in debt. That's why we had to go off the gold
standard. I think we're going to have another one, and a big one. That's my guess.
Let's hope not, George, but that's not something that I would argue with. I mean, this whole business in the Middle East is staged. It's just staged.
What they do, John, is they take real concerns, real issues, and then they magnify it, and then they twist it, and then they get the right players involved with it. And then, of course, where there's always something, there's always a bit of truth to everything, right? It always starts off that way. And I think the same thing is in the Middle East. And then all of a sudden, it just explodes.
Well, you're right. I agree with you. I agree with that assessment. In the Middle East, as diverse as the religious views are, the truth of the matter is somebody is keeping that fomented. Rational people could sit down and work out these problems and work out agreements that would work, but there are elements behind the scenes that keep that pot stirred.
Exactly. These people, the ones you're mentioning in terms of the elitists, that's what I'll call them, they don't want a peaceful planet.
No, they don't.
If there was no real terrorism, I think they'd create it just to keep things in chaos.
Well, one can look back over the last decade since 9/11 and look at the draconian measures that have been enforced on this country, to say nothing about others, from the Patriot Act to the fact, George, that we stand here in June 2010 with 30 million surveillance cameras in this country, taking 4 billion feet of footage of American citizens every single week. What have we come to, George?
I know. Do you think it's conceivable that a group went to an Osama bin Laden and said, we're going to finance you, even though this was a low-tech operation, we're going to take care of this, we're not going to hurt you, we're going to pretend we're after you, but, you know, you're going to go on your merry way. As a matter of fact, we've got a home area for you and your family. You're better than you are in Tora Bora here. And we're going to we just want you to do this. We need this done. So he gets these martyrs, these nuts, and they get on the plane and they do what they're going to do, but that it was all arranged. Could you believe that?
Yes.
You could.
Yeah, I can believe it because of the consequences of what's occurred. And I have read, I haven't jumped into that point of view. I've read and read and read Jim Marr's book, yeah. Inside Job, the Terror Conspiracy.
It took you a while to get there. John, we're already at the top of the hour. Let's come back. We've got two more hours with you. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Text message in from Jim, and he just wants to know if our economic crisis is premeditated by other entities like terrorism or something like that. What do you think, John?
Well, I think it's premeditated. I think the terrorism, the so-called war on terror is something that is created to divert the public's attention. I think these things are probably linked in some way, but the financial crisis and the premeditation of it is actually something designed by these guys in Basel, Switzerland, and is it was created, and we'll get to the mechanisms of exactly what happened and how it came about. But it's not an agenda aligned with the terrorism of the Muslim extremists. I don't believe
they must love though seeing this worldwide chaos.
Yeah, they do. That's what they thrive on. That's their soul food, so to speak.
They're probably at home going, look what we've done. Look at Greece. They're falling apart. Look at Hungary. They're next.
Well, that's really the second act in this play, George. What's going on with Greece and the euro and Hungary and Spain and Portugal and all the negative PR that is coming out of Europe, the fiscal PR coming out of Europe, is really the second act in a play. The first act was here, the second act is there, and both of these are designed to create fear and consternation to enable the Bank for International Settlements, the IMF and World Bank along with them, to, quote, come to the rescue, to become a global financial control mechanism. These things were planned. They were planned to frighten people, and they were planned to push power and resource to international control mechanisms. That's why they occurred. They didn't just happen.
And I have to believe that the plan is to just cripple all these nations at the same time.
It's to keep them down economically, to keep them economically on the edge, scraping for every dollar, being in some kind of condition that they always have to make a little bit more. Not necessarily crushing them the governments want tax dollars and so forth, but just keeping them on the edge. And importantly, as we talked about in the last hour, being in control of that and being able to call the shots. If you are able to control the monetary currency, the monetary supplies of whether it's the euro or the dollar or the yen, you can essentially control the economy in the country. You control the money. I forget the quote that I think was one of the Rothschilds made, you know. Let me control a country's money, and I care not about their laws. And that's what's occurring here now. It's occurring on our watch.
Where do the Chinese fit into all of this?
Well, that's an interesting question. After I put the book together, a friend of mine got it to some friends of his in Taipei, and they sent it to some people in Beijing. And I got an email saying that the Chinese government wanted to have me fly over there and consult with them on the financial crisis and the solutions and so forth. And I thought it was a joke, George. I thought it was a joke. So I said, you know, have them fly me over business class and put me up in a nice hotel. I'll think about it. And 24 hours later, here came the invitation. And the Chinese government flew me to Beijing. I spent a week there meeting with very senior members of the Chinese Ministry of Finance. And what's interesting, when you back up from this and look at it a little bit, here is the major communist nation on planet Earth with $3 trillion in reserves. And here we are, the beacon of free enterprise, $13 trillion in debt. Now, what's the matter with this picture? Well, you could go into a lot of directions, but one thing is that the Western Keynesian economic bankers who took over Western Europe and America through the Bank of England and the Fed did not get their claws into the Chinese. And so while the Chinese have got more than their share of human rights problems, which is its own situation, from the standpoint of finance, these folks are pretty sane. Their concern in talking to them were twofold. One was that of their $3 trillion in reserves, about $800 billion of that is U.S. debt. And as the dollar goes down, so too does the value of their reserves. And so they're trying to force the United States to exhibit some fiscal responsibility. And, of course, we're doing nothing of the kind. I mean, the president came out yesterday, I think it was, calling for another $50 billion in basically in welfare aid. But Geithner has been to Beijing. The people from China have been over here. They're going, you know, stop this insane spending. You know, you people are smoking something. Stop it. But we haven't stopped. And so they have taken two different tacks. One is to build up their internal economy so that they're not so reliant on exporting to the United States. I was walking down Wangfu Jing Boulevard, which is the Rodeo Drive of Beijing. This is a huge street, George. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a huge wide street with every brand in the world on the street. It's February. It's freezing. It's a Sunday night. It's 8 o'clock, and the place is packed. The street is packed. You can't even get a car on the street. There are people everywhere. So they have put a lot of attention on building up their internal economy. And secondly, they are collecting gold. I had dinner with the president of China Gold, Mr. Zhang. That is the government-owned gold mining consortium. 40,000 employees, George. China's the biggest gold producer on the planet. And this guy's buying up gold mines all over the planet. He's just chomp, chomp, chomp. And they are one of the things that they talked to me a bunch about. I did an interview on Chinese television and so forth. Was backing the yuan with gold.
And they're buying gold like crazy out there.
They are accumulating it very heavily and very rapidly. So how they fit into it is, at this point, the Western bankers don't have their teeth into that scene, but they're trying. In talking to members of the Ministry of Finance, I got some insight into that, and the Wall Street boys are trying to get their claws into, their teeth into the Chinese economy, and while they've made a little bit of progress, they haven't done it fully yet.
How did the Chinese accumulate so much wealth?
Well, they've accumulated because they have kept the yuan, their currency, which is called the yuan. The currency actually has two names, the yuan or the renminbi, which is abbreviated RMB. They've kept that currency low. They have forced the value of it low. They pegged it to the dollar, and they just keep it suppressed. By keeping the value of their currency low, their exports are very inexpensive. And so you find in the United States and the Walmarts of the world and so forth that so many goods are made in China. So China has a massive export and a massive trade balance. So as they're sending goods overseas, they're collecting in return billions and billions and billions of dollars.
So they're going with volume, aren't they?
They're going with volume, and they're going with controlled volume because they're keeping their currency low, keeping the prices of their goods low. It's the problem that they have, George, because they've got $800 billion in U.S. debt. If the dollar continues to fall, they're losing their reserves. So to some degree, they want to try and keep the U.S. economy going, so we'll continue to buy their goods.
Right. They can't kill the biggest client they have.
The goose. That's exactly right.
The American manufacturers contend that the Chinese currency is undervalued by as much as 40%.
It is undervalued. There's no question that it's undervalued. And 40% may even be low. I think if they let that currency float freely, it would probably double overnight.
I have always wondered why Russia, why China hasn't tried to step in whenever we have gone into a country militarily. In the old days, you'd have that standoff.
Right.
I don't see that happening anymore. We seem to be able to go any place we want at any time. The Russians somewhat within their own region. China, of course, holding back right now, but they're not trying to stop us like the old days, Why?
Well, one, Russia has just begun to get back on her feet. I mean, the CIS after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and while that's been 21 years ago or so, it's taken a long time for the Russian economy and the Russian military to get back on its feet. Putin has just started to flex those muscles a little bit.
Right.
So I don't think they've been as strong as they were, or at least as strong as they pretended to be, George, in the during the Cold War. As far as the Chinese, I think they're very cagey. They're building their military. They're building their economic might. And it would not surprise me for them to walk across the Straits of Formosa, grab up Taiwan. And when we objected, they would go, hey.
Look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan. That's what they'll say.
Yeah. They'll say, look at Iraq and look at Afghanistan. They'll also say, shut up or I'll sell your treasury bills.
Yeah.
Which we can't tolerate.
We'll dump them, right?
Yes. Yeah. If they sell them, then that crashes our dollar further. It drives interest rates up here. They can basically dictate on the U.S. to the U.S. economy.
I see that happening too. As a matter of fact, I'm a little baffled it hasn't happened already.
I think they're taking their time. I think they're kind of planning their moves. That said, the people that I talk to are not evil, vicious Yankee haters. I just didn't get that.
They're capitalists, aren't they?
They are capitalists. I mean, this so-called experiment in China, which started 20-some-odd years ago, of this kind of free market communism, for lack of a better term, is a little bit bizarre, because you have them just gradiently, slowly taking the reins and controls off of the Chinese economy for, you know, in terms of a free market economy, slowly. But the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, still runs the PRC, the People's Republic of China, and they're, you know, it's still a dictatorship. It's a very odd mixture. I think at some point the free market system will get so big that they will not be able to turn it off, so to speak, or control it. They're trying to have it both ways, and so far they've been able to have it both ways. The Chinese economy, the yuan, in my opinion, is the strongest currency in the planet, and that's because it's backed by production. Those people work their
tushes. That's their asset, isn't it?
It is
the production.
Asset. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and they're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They are where we were 15, 20 years ago.
They are right now the number two economy, about to pass or have just passed Japan as the number two economy on the planet, and time will come when they are the number one economy on the planet.
Now, this plan to bring us down to our knees, what do they want?
They want control, George. They want control. They want to be able to do just what we were talking about a little bit ago. They want to be able to control economies. They want to keep people down. They want to keep them oppressed. They want to be able to control the production of various economies.
If they're going to do that here, they've got to try to take our guns away.
Yes, they do. And you can see that in this administration, these kind of covert actions to try and take out the Second Amendment. Clearly that's on the agenda, in my opinion. That's on the agenda.
It has to be if they're going to try to control us. They cannot have a population armed.
No, they can't. And it's why I think the current political mood of the country is so important, for people to let the legislators know that they're not going to stand for the fiscal insanity and the I mean, these guys just sit up there and pass laws that they don't read. We all know that now. The TARP bill, 1,000 pages, nobody read it. This health care bill, 2,400 pages, nobody read it, or virtually nobody read it. It's a joke. Congress is a joke. It's funny. If you talk to them, George, one-on-one, representatives or senators, which I have done, they're decent people. Most of them are decent people. But as a group, as a committee, they act insanely.
Yeah. I believe that. I want to talk with you after the break about, when we come back, about this oil spill and how that fits into the equation of everything.
Sure.
The stock market seems to be just barely hanging on to that 10,000 level. It should be 6 to 8. How is it so inflated? How is it able to hold on this way?
Well, there's. I agree with you. I agree with you exactly, and even per the numbers. That said, the Dow Jones is totally manipulated and totally controlled. And if you've got a break coming up, we can get into it afterwards. But there's a book that explains how they do it. And I will tell your listeners, it's not my book, but another book that kind of peels the onion on that. It's a book by a guy named Ted Warren. It's called How to Make the Stock Market Make Money for You. It's got a corny title. But the manipulation of markets is detailed in that book. It's an old book, I think, available on – it's out of print, but I think it's available on Amazon.
Speaking of books and things, Crisis by Design, is this being turned into a movie? I hear rumors.
You hear rumors. Well, the book has been optioned to a production company here in Los Angeles. Screenplay has been written. We're raising money for it.
Independent?
Yes, independent.
Okay. Who will star in this one?
What
are your visions?
Well,
and who would and what a star c- character be? Who would they be? These are unknown people, right?
Well, the way we've got it crafted now, it's a documentary, George.
And okay.
So the stars will be people like Alan Greenspan. Stars, in quotes, will be people like Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, George Soros, et cetera. That's how it's currently structured as a documentary.
When you were putting this together, the book, Crisis by Design, anything there that kind of frightened you as a human being?
Well, it doesn't frighten me. It angers me. Not frightened, but it angers me. And it's why I wrote the book and put some solutions down there so people can, take responsibility and do something about it and not just, sometimes we get afflicted with, bitch about it, just kind of sit and complain and, the government's doing this, they're doing this, they're doing this. Well, it's true. They may be doing that, but there's always something you can do about it. There are solutions in the book, as I said, both in terms for the individual and...
Which is critical, I think.
It's absolutely critical because you have to protect yourself and your family. You have to protect yourself and your family. But in addition, if you just do that and leave the government to, and just kind of kiss it off and go, these guys are never going to listen or whatever, you can't give up on this. You can't give up on this country. There's too much good here. I don't care, what kind of stuff gets thrown at America. We are still the beacon of liberty here, and we need to get back and deserve that appellation.
Can we get back, or is it too late?
No, we can. We can. Not easy. Not a walk in the park. But by all means,
especially when some of them are Americans trying to do this.
Yes, you're right. You're right. You have, as you were to use your word, some treasonous conduct by people. I think it's treasonous that the United States Congress approves $1.8 trillion in a budget deficit. I think it's outrageous.
Oh my God! If we did that, we'd be bankrupt.
Yeah. Here's a government where the Social Security is bankrupt, Amtrak is bankrupt, the Post Office is bankrupt, Medicare is bankrupt, and they pass a bill to take
Fannie and Freddie Mae are bankrupt.
With $160 billion of taxpayer dollars in there, AIG is bankrupt. We own AIG.
We own them all. John Truman Wolf with us. I'll be back in a moment. His website behindthewizardscurtain.com. I like that. We'll be back. The situation in the Gulf of Mexico, John, out of control right now. Do you see that affecting world economies at all?
Well, it hasn't to date, George. One continues to look for a solution to this, and a touch of nepotism here. My wife is the president of an environmental group, and she's down there now with working on, they have solutions, a microorganism solution that actually eats the oil. It's unbelievable. So we'll see if she can get some folks to adopt that. But there doesn't seem to be, in terms of capping this thing, you'd think these people would have the expertise to do so. What bothers me about it, and this is not a direct answer to your question, because if it gets into politics, is the president is just making a political issue out of this. He's flying down there every few days and trying to convince people this or that. He can't do anything about this. He mouths off about it and beats up on BP like he beat up on the bankers, and he beat up on the automobile industry, and he beats up on the insurance company. So now he's beating up on BP. That doesn't do any good. It doesn't show any altitude or ethics presence as a president. So I find that troubling. Relative to your question, only to the degree that politicians and or the media try to make it affect the economy. I don't think at this point it's a factor. Now, maybe it'll get to a point that the price of oil goes up to $150 again a barrel, as it did last year, as Goldman Sachs manipulated it up to $150 a barrel. But right this minute, I don't see it affecting the world economy.
At all?
Not that I can see. Not that I can see. It's obviously affecting the fishermen in the Gulf. But if you're talking about the world economy, I don't see it, George, not right this minute, to be very frank with you.
This crisis that we seem to be going through right now, can you give us a little crystal ball glimpse into how you think the U.S. economy is going to go in the next year or two?
I think sooner rather than later, interest rates will begin to rise. Now, that doesn't, you don't have to be the Oracle of Delphi to say that, but it is, it's a natural consequence. I don't want to beat this issue up of the $1.8 trillion deficit any more than I already have, except relative to the answer to your question, when you have deficits of that size, you start printing. And we talked about the Chinese buying or not buying our debt. The government is going to have to increase the interest rates on debt, and that'll drive up other interest rates to get other people to buy our debt, because people think that we're, you know, fiscally nuts, and they're right. So interest rates will go up. That will be harmful to the U.S. economy. It affects, you know, mortgage rates. It affects auto rates. It affects your credit card rates, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think with this administration we're going to see anything but further oppression of the economy. I've never seen anything like this, George, and what I'm talking about is this government that are pushing, that don't care what they spend, and that are pushing mandates on the American people. This health care bill is an example. It's not that the health care system in this country doesn't need to be reformed. It does. But ordering people to get health insurance who may not need it or want it, I think is outrageous. And the taxes tied up in that bill are huge. When you have deficits of this size, governments, among other things, come after the public for taxes. Taxes will go up. Interest rates will go up. Both of these things will be depressive on the U.S. economy. There's nothing that's going on in Washington that leads me to believe in the near future, which is how you asked the question, that this is going to get any better. This administration, on top of the health care bill and this banking bill, George, that passed a couple of weeks ago that gives the Federal Reserve a whole bunch more power, on top of those two agendas is this so-called cap-and-trade bill, which the president is now trying to use the crisis in the Gulf to pass the cap-and-trade bill. And for those that don't understand what that is, that's a bill that would put limits on the amount of production, on the amount of energy you can produce, and they'll tax it. It's outrageous. And hopefully, I don't want to get political here, but hopefully there'll be enough of a change in government in November that the brakes get put on this stuff, because every single piece of legislation that has come out of Congress has been harmful and or will be harmful to the American public.
Every piece. That's frightening.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you followed it. Jim Bunning, the great Phillies pitcher who later became...
And Detroit Tigers pitcher.
A great pitcher. And he goes to the U.S. Senate, and he becomes a wonderful senator. And he stands up on the floor of the Senate. We're going, back a couple of months. And they were trying to pass an extended jobs bill, just adding to continue to pay people not to work. And when you pay people not to work, they don't work. But he wasn't even saying don't do that. What he was saying is simply tell me how you're going to pay for it. He put a hold on the bill. Most people don't know that any senator can place a hold on a bill, and it's very difficult to shake a hold loose. It can be done, but it's hard. So he put a hold on that bill, which was for, I was a, quote, small, end quote, amount of money, $18 billion, $25 billion, something like that. And all he said was, tell me how we're going to pay for it. Please, somebody tell me how we're going to pay for this. And he got so pillared and was marginalized to such an extent he finally relented. I'm sorry that he relented, but he did. But it gives you an idea of the mindset in the United States Congress. These people are addicted to spending, George, like a heroin junkie.
That's true. They're out of control.
Yeah.
Absolutely out of control.
So I don't see much in the way of bright lights for the American economy in the next year.
How about kids coming out of college? What do they have to look forward to?
Well, you know, all of what I just said, which sounds a little doom and gloomish, but that said, there remains, you know, great opportunities. I mean, look what these kids can do with technology today. I was having dinner with my son and his two daughters, my two granddaughters, here a couple of weeks ago, and the four-year-old, George, is on the iPhone typing out, you know, I'm like...
Oh, they're incredible.
So this generation has got a great opportunity in terms of technology. There is a need for good leadership, people that want to go into public service, that care about the country and are more concerned about what's beneficial to the country and keeping the government out of our lives. It doesn't belong in our lives. It just doesn't. That's not what the Founding Fathers thought about. That's not what the Constitution says. We'll see what happens to this health care bill with the 20 attorney generals filing suit. And that suit was joined, I think it was last week, by NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is a huge small business lobby. And that'll get to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later, I think. So we'll see what happens to that. But I think there's still great opportunity. I think there's great opportunity in technology. I think there's great opportunity in public service. You can do so much by yourself. You know this 1,000 times better than I. People can get on the internet and, you know, create their YouTube videos and promote their business and write their screenplay or write their book or do whatever. So that has opened up a great world of opportunity. And for people, kids, young folks that have the motivation, that's really what it takes, is motivation and purpose and hard work.
Why didn't anybody stop these bankers?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. They're very smoke and mirrors kind of people. You go back to, and I'm sure you've had many guests on your show that have talked about the 16th Amendment and this thing being passed in the dark of night back in 1916, or the passage of the income tax bill and the passage of the bill, was it 1913, of that established the Fed. Once the Fed was in place, it's almost as if the public gets hypnotized, George. I go back to the point I was making a little earlier in the show, and when I would sit and watch Alan Greenspan, talk to legislators, and he's saying nothing, George. He's saying it's truly economic psychobabble, and the legislators don't call him on it. Nobody stops him and goes, Mr. Chairman, what do you mean by that? What exactly in practical words or actions do you mean by that? Bernanke does the same thing. I don't know if you saw the YouTube video where I think it was Alan Grayson, the congressman from Florida, who's grilling the inspector general of the Fed about where a couple of trillion dollars went. Now, this woman, who's the inspector general, she's the inspector general of the Federal Reserve Bank, and he's going, where'd the money go? And she goes, you know, congressman, we're happy to work with you, and I'll get back to you on that. And he asks her the question from three or four or five different perspectives. She never answers him. So
I wonder if she wanted to plead the fifth.
she just non-answered him. All of that said, I still think there are great opportunities. It just takes, as I said, motivation and doing what you enjoy and working hard at it.
Well, like I said, they have an arrogance about them. The Bilderbergs, are you familiar with this organization, this group?
Yeah, to some degree, yes. I mean, I'm a Jim Mars reader and so forth. I'm honored to call him a friend, and I read his books, and I read some of the other, you read the books on the CFR and the Trilateral Commission and, and so forth. So, yes, I'm somewhat familiar with the Bilderbergers, yes.
They're all part of the club, aren't they?
They are part of the club. If you look at this so-called global warming agenda, this started with an organization called the Club of Rome, who met at the Rockefeller Estate in Bellagio, Italy in 1968, and then saw to the publication of a book called The Limits to Growth. And that book they pushed around the world, and that became the theory, the philosophy of the current global warming movement, which is a different subject. But it's to some degree part of what we're talking about, because global warming is a flank to global government. If you can mandate how much energy gets produced in a country or in a state or in a city, you can control the production of that city, county, or state. You can control how much economies thrive or not. So if these guys have control of the money, which they do now from the Bank of International Settlements, the Financial Stability Board, the little group in there, and the United States passes this cap and trade bill, and I would encourage your listeners to tell their senators not to pass it, but if that passes, and or if the globalist meeting in Mexico in November to try and pass another one of these international global warming treaties, if any of these things happen, you know, they've got control of the money and they've got control of the production. And you got those two things. You got your hand on the throat of the planet.
Do you see the mainstream media picking this up at all?
No. No, I mean, not to any great degree. Certainly, some of the guys on Fox do a pretty good job of it. Glenn Beck, dabbles in these waters, as does Hannity and O'Reilly and Greta. I don't see anything of the networks on this at all. Certainly, you don't see it out of CNN.
Is it because they're just not aware of it?
No, I don't think it's not. I don't think it's because they're not aware of it. I think they are arrogant. I think they have a view that they know it all. I think that they think that these things that get talked about are from a bunch of conspiracy nuts, and it disturbs their, their operating basis in life, and they just don't write about it. They don't write about it because it would disturb the social fabric. These are historic times we're living in, George. I mean, these things have never happened before. Yes, governments have been in debt, but not like now. Yes, there have been wars, but not like this war on terror, which is this nebulous kind of war on anything. You know, a terrorist is defined however somebody wants to define them. There was something that came out of the White House a year ago, May, George, where the president said he was looking for a legal basis for a so-called preventive detention. I don't know if you saw the Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg film a few years ago, Minority Report.
Oh, sure did. Yeah.
And so there was a science fiction aspect to that. But the legal basis of that film was that you could arrest someone before they committed a crime. And the president has said he's looking for a legal basis to do just that, be able to arrest people before they commit a crime, if they've got terrorist activities. You add to that, George, the fact that there are so-called fusion centers being built up around the country. I don't know if you know this term, but these are data collection points that gather data on people and then disseminate it to state, local state, and federal authorities.
As they deem fit to do,
yeah.
I guess. Right?
And you may remember a year or so ago when the Missouri Fusion Center issued a memo to Missouri law enforcement that third-party candidates could be violent or terrorist, and they picked up the head of Ron Paul's campaign.
Yeah, they even had our buddy Alex Jones on the list. I don't know if you know Alex. Yeah.
Yeah. So these kinds of things haven't happened before, and it's why I wrote the book, and it's why people need to get active and do something, because we can do something about it. I don't think it's so far gone that we can't fix it.
Zbigniew Brzezinski at a CFR meeting, Council on Foreign Relations, told them that the general public is becoming more and more aware of what they're doing, and he's concerned.
Well, he should be concerned. This is a guy that is advising Obama on foreign policy, as you probably know. You have behind the president the funding of George Soros and the foreign policy advice of Zbigniew Brzezinski. This is a founder, as you, I'm sure you know, is a founder with David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission.
That's right.
So this is not a this is the icon or a demonstration or a symbol of the so-called global elite. Zbigniew, who was for your listeners that don't know, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, is a bad actor. This is a guy who looks down on the population as if they are so many ants or insects.
That's true. Absolutely true. All right, tell me, where do you get the book, Crisis by Design?
The book is available at behindthewizardscurtain.com, behindthewizardscurtain.com. Now, folks can get there and get a copy of the book. It's an e-book. They download it. There's a bunch of bonuses and other things that they get with the book. But behindthewizardscurtain.com.
And your website, behindthewizardscurtain.com, you got from The Wizard of Oz?
Well, the first article, the book is a compendium of articles I wrote on the financial crisis as it was rolling out. And the first article that I wrote was entitled The Financial Crisis, A Look Behind the Wizard's Curtain. And that thing hit the internet. I sent it to a few friends, and it exploded around the world. I've never experienced anything like it. Viral marketing, I guess, or it wasn't marketing so much, just viral program. And I was getting calls from people all over the world, Japan and France and New Zealand. I mean, it was unbelievable. And so we just took that name and used it for the website, Behind the Wizard's Curtain.
All right. Well, you stick with us. We're going to come back for a final hour with you, John Truman Wolf. And we'll take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. And here we are with John Truman Wolf and your phone calls as well. John, if you had a magic wand and you're able to wave it over all these people, what would you want to happen to them?
That's a very good question, George. I would want a couple of things to happen. First and foremost, if I'm just talking about the United States, I would repeal the income tax and replace it with a national sales tax. If I were going to reform the monetary system, I would do what we talked about in an earlier part of the show, which is base currency on production and real estate, not fiat. I would also ensure that there were checks and balances and oversight on any kind of international financial organization. By that, I mean a representative form of international government, like the Constitution, whereby representatives could oversee any of the things that were going on in terms of international financial regulation. An international financial body isn't in and of itself evil. It's what people do with it. There are foreign currencies on the planet. They do have to be exchanged. There is trade that occurs between different currencies in different countries, in different products. The free flow of goods and money has to occur. So organizations to facilitate that are probably necessary. But I would have some kind of representative checks and balances over these guys, so that they quit ruining the lives with their greed, lives of people with their greed.
And lots of greed out there, too.
Yeah.
To the phones we go. East of the Rockies, John, in the state of Washington. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, John.
How's it going, George? How's it going, John?
Good.
Good.
I was wondering, how can these guys get away with this so blatantly? I mean, they get on television and tell you, no, we're not telling you where the money went, and, it's like, why can't we have like a class action lawsuit and put these people in jail?
Well, they should be put in jail for what they're doing. In terms of how they get by with it, Congress hasn't flexed its muscles. As we talked about a little bit earlier, and as George mentioned, Dr. Ron Paul introduced legislation to audit the Fed, which would have disclosed what these guys are doing. That bill passed the House. When it got to the Senate, it got a typical water down there. And, you know, people, well, Chris Dodd, who was in charge of that committee, is not running again. But people have to, you know, they have to step up to the plate, as mad or upset or as intent as people are to get things changed. They have to persist. And I'm talking now about communicating to your elected officials. This does work. I have seen it work. So we can't give up on it. In terms of the audit the Fed bill, we ought to demand after the November elections that they go back and, you know, repass in the Senate the bill that Dr. Ron Paul wanted. We need to audit the Fed. The truth of the matter is we should get rid of the Fed. I don't think Congress right now has got the guts to do that. There's no reason in the world that we have the Federal Reserve Bank or should have the Federal Reserve Bank printing the money in this country. That's Congress's prerogative per the Constitution. The Federal Reserve Bank should be, you know, should just go its way.
Good point. Okay, next up, let's go to John in Mesa, Arizona. Go ahead, John. You're up with us.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I had a question regarding China's trade policy with the United States. Earlier in the program, you stated that they keep sending cheap goods over here, and we essentially pay for it with IOUs. Now, the Chinese are holding all this debt of ours, and it's really in their best interest to get rid of it and putting it something into, like, gold or some commodity. But you're saying they're trying to perpetuate this game and keep it going, but it seems like it's a circular loop. The more debt they have, the more at risk they are, but they have to keep the game going. So where does it stop?
It is a circular loop, and you're correct. However, as I said a little bit earlier, China's doing two things. They've got a problem. I mean, which you've pointed out, which is they don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, to use George's analogy. But what they have done is they have put a lot of attention economically internally, so that the Chinese people can be buying their own goods, and there is a dramatic increase in the amount of economic activity by Chinese citizens, so that the government can wean themselves off of the American teat, so to speak. Additionally, as I also said, they're accumulating gold big time, and their buying of U.S. debt has decreased dramatically. So they've cut back on their buying of U.S. debt. They are focusing their economy internally, and they're buying gold.
Wow. But it seems like you've discounted the position of gold going forward, though. So how does that stand with the average person? Because it seems like that's the only lifeboat left.
I didn't quite follow. I discounted the gold.
Oh, I'm saying that I was looking on your website, and you addressed the confiscation of gold, and I think you mentioned earlier in your show that that's still a card that they hold. But China's trying to accumulate gold now, and the average person in the United States, and myself included, are trying to amass gold because they see what's coming.
Right.
But evidently, that doesn't seem to be a panacea here. So if it's the only lifeboat left, where do you go?
Well, I think it's one lifeboat left. I think, you know, having some precious metals in reserves is extremely important. The bottom line is that a person's most valuable asset is their ability to produce whatever it is that they want to do in life, whether it's, a book or a film or a painting, or it's a rehabbed Chevy pickup, or it's whatever. I mean, the asset that we have is our own ability to get things done, to create and to get things done, and to get things produced and to get them sold. I'm just talking about that from an individual perspective. From a national perspective, if you're talking about China, if I'm looking at that from the viewpoint of the Chinese government, I think they're doing the right things. If you're talking about what does an individual in the United States do, I think the answer to that is, accumulate some precious metals, gold and silver, hang on to them, and work your butt off.
Have you ever seen it this bad in terms of people's moods, the stress factor? It's huge.
There's two aspects to this, George. You're right, it is huge, and from that perspective, the answer is no. On the other hand, as I said earlier in the show, if there's a silver lining here, it's the fact that what's coming out of Washington is so angering people that in truth they have woken up and they have become more active. I think this country is more awake politically and more active politically than it's been in decades and decades and decades. At the same time, part of that and what may be driving it is exactly what you said. There's a great deal of economic stress in the country, a lot of it. When you're out of work, people want to, work. I mean, by that, I mean they like to produce things. They like to have a sense of dignity, and that comes from working and producing a product. And in a growing number of cases, that has been taken away from people, and it does create stress. So you have these two factors kind of rolling forward in the American society currently.
All right, we'll go to Ray in California up next. Go ahead, Ray. You're up with us.
George, hi. I'm the Korean vet that called a few weeks back and lost it and didn't get out what I wanted to ask.
Ah, okay.
You remember?
Yeah.
Anyhow, today I got a hold of it. But what I'd like to tell you is George Soros, that they said, is funding the failure to take the guns away from the American people. He's trying it now through Hillary Clinton in the UN and through the New World Order. Now, what I'd like to have you do, if you would, because there's lots of gun owners in this country, is to get hold of the NRA, Chris Cox or Wayne LaPree, and have them on a program, and he will give us the information as what's going on behind it to take our guns away from us. I'm a Second Amendment man. I know you are. I'm also a concealed weapons holder, like you are. And they want to disarm us, George. And California, I live in communist California. We got 50 pages of gun laws in the state. They just passed another one where it goes into effect where you have to give a thumbprint and your ID to buy a box of ammunition.
I mean, but and those are for the law-abiding people. The criminals don't have to abide by any of that.
No, They make it tougher for us to do it. And every year it keeps going up, and I don't know why it's the Democrats, but George Soros is funding it, and he wants to do it. He wants to disarm
it. Well, he's a globalist.
That's right.
He's a
globalist. But I'm afraid, because they're trying it through the UN Charter now, and Hillary Clinton touched on it one time on the news, and I think she slipped it out, didn't mean to say it, about going through the UN. But I know how you feel, and if they disarm us, every communist country are disarmed. That's how they take over the country. You know that as well as I do.
Absolutely. What are they doing in Europe with respect to guns? We've seen them take them out of Britain. What's going on, John?
Well, I don't know all of the laws in Europe on that. I know they're gone from Britain. I know I've read studies and articles showing that in every single country where the government has taken guns away, the crime rate has soared. So this has been true in Australia. I've read a lot of friends down in down under and have a number of, quote, horror stories from Australia regarding guns being confiscated. I know that's true in England. I don't know what the laws are in Germany and France, George, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure what the gun laws are there.
Text message in from Billy in Toronto. What do you think the major stage event will be to implement the New World Order?
Well, I think it's in progress. I think this this created financial crisis, and I think the signing of this agreement on August 2nd, 2009 at the G20 meeting in the UK was a major, major, major step. The financial control of the planet, certainly of the central banks of the planet, has been placed in the Bank for International Settlements. I remind people this is not some, quote, conspiracy theory, end quote. This has occurred. This has actually occurred. So this agenda is moving forward. And for those in the U.S. that are listening, I repeat, it's important to call your Congress folks, men or women, your senators, and wake them up and tell them that this agreement has been signed by the president in April of 2009, and they have to be responsible. I've talked to people in Congress about this, George. They don't have a clue. They're not aware of this.
They're not.
No.
Isn't that something? Pulled right over their eyes.
Yep.
Let's go to Brad in New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Brad.
Hi, George. Hi, John.
Hi.
Remember the late Eisenhower days when your biggest worry was the flat tire on your bicycle? I like to go back to those melancholy days sometimes.
And 25 cent a gallon gasoline.
Yes. But my question to you, John, is the global currency issue. And I'm trying to figure out what country or what continent, who's going to benefit if we ever go to that? And why would George Soros want it? I mean, to me, it seems like a one-shot deal for him. If he's positioned right, he'll make a lot of money at one time. But I don't see the point of global currency. Could you just
say? Well, the point of global currency, Brad, is that if the elitists, if the guys in Basel, Switzerland, if the folks in the Bank of International Settlements and or the International Monetary Fund can control a world currency, when you control the monetary supply, you basically control the country. What is happening now, again, as we speak, is that the SDR, the Special Drawing Rights, which is the currency of the International Monetary Fund, is replacing the dollar slowly, gradiently, in central banks around the world so that it becomes the reserve currency. And if they can control that, and they can control it because they just manufacture it, then they can control the amount of currency in circulation and thereby control economies. Relative to George Soros, the guy's 87 years old. He's a billionaire.
He's bored, right?
Huh?
He's bored. So he's doing this. It's a game for him.
Yeah. I mean, he is quoted in the UK Telegraph as saying that this financial crisis was the crowning achievement of his career. And he said, I had a very good financial crisis. So this guy is one of the key Darth Vaders on the planet. And not a good guy. But that's the purpose of having a global currency, Brad.
Tom is in Connecticut, first time caller. Go ahead, Tom.
This is a great subject. This cuts right to the heart of the problem. And you know, you used the term vampire before. That's one of the terms I like to use when I'm talking to people about this. Another term I like to use is that they're an international banking mafia, and that they use their perceived power that they get from being able to control the monetary systems of the world to control everything. And there's a woman by the name of Ellen Brown who has a book, The Web of Debt. Are you familiar with that?
I'm very familiar with Ellen. One of the bonuses that you get when you go to Behind the Wizard's Curtain and get my book is you get an interview that I did with Ellen as a free bonus. So I know her well. I've read her book, and she and I are very much on the same page.
That's great, because yeah, the two of you are like at the forefront of this fight, because this is truly the fight for freedom for all mankind to take this perceived power away from these international banking mafia vampires they suck the wealth of the working people away so they can live their fabulous lives of luxury in mansions and yachts and private jets and limos, while we work in the fields like serfs.
The only thing that I would disagree with there, Tom, is this. While they may be driving around in limos and flying their private jets, these guys are, as George was pointing out earlier, they are petrified. They are so afraid that the average guy that you're talking about wakes up and is going to do something about it. So while they're driving around in a lot of luxury, I don't think they're happy at all. I think they're scared to death.
These were people who, when they were kids, were probably afraid to go to school.
Or abused animals or something.
Something like that. Absolutely. Well, the next push, too, I think, will be the manipulation of some war.
Well,
they've got to get something to get the minds off what's going on right now.
Yeah, as we discussed, George, I mean, I think if that's going to happen, it'll happen in the Middle East.
Saudi Arabia is giving Israel permission to go over its airspace.
Yes.
That's done.
I saw that, yeah.
I mean, that's a prelude to something. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that, do we?
No, you don't. I mean, as I'm sure you know, much of what's going on in Iraq and particularly Afghanistan has to do with oil, and it has to do with poppy production. I was staggered to find out, George, that let me preface this by saying I'm no fan of the Taliban here. But under their jurisdiction, during most of their jurisdiction, poppy production in Afghanistan
It's way up.
It was way down. Now that the U.S. has arrived, it's way up. You know where the heroin's going from Afghanistan, and why the U.S. is protecting the poppy fields there?
It's coming here, isn't it?
No, it's going to Russia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 80% of it's going to Russia. Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's heroin or poppy production, and so the United States is happy to have them do that and send it to Russia. It's a covert operation.
And screw up all the Russians.
That's right. And Putin just came out with, there was an article on this a day or so ago, where Putin's getting very angry and talking about supporting the Taliban against us because of so much heroin coming into Russia.
Interesting. We'll come back with final phone calls in a moment. John Truman Wolf, our guest, Crisis by Design. Do you think Reagan understood any of this, John?
Well, I don't think these guys had their hands around the throat of the American economy at that time, you know, during the 80s that they do now. Did he understand that Wall Street was pulling some strings? Yes, I believe he did.
But stood by and watched it happen. I guess they all did.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think various presidents have tried to do things about this, but none of them have been successful. I'm sure you've read the stories about the fact that John Kennedy, a few short months before he was killed,
tried to do away with the Federal Reserve.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. West of the Rockies, Mike is with us in Alaska. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I've always wondered, what purpose did they have for starting the Federal Reserve? There had to have been some positive reason. I know it's mostly negative, but I'm just wondering if there's anything you could say that is positive about the Federal Reserve system.
You know, Mike, my mind is a blank on that question. There's really nothing positive about it at all due respect. I mean, why they created it is so that they could make money. Understand that the Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air. When the government issues treasury bonds or treasury bills, which are basically government IOUs, the Federal Reserve just clicks a mouse and deposits money in the government's bank account, or if they may be buying it from banks or the government. But they just create money out of thin air. And then they charge interest on it, Mike. So I don't find that anything but oppressive. I don't find any benefit to it at all. It is harmful to the country. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on interest on the national debt. If the government was printing the money itself, there wouldn't be any interest on the debt. So this just makes billions for a bunch of private bankers. The Federal Reserve, as George pointed out earlier in the show, is a private institution. This is not a government institution.
Well, wouldn't that mean that anybody who pushed this thing through initially back in 1916, whenever it was, and anybody today is guilty of treason against our country?
Well, George brought that up earlier, and you won't get any argument from me on that.
Thank you.
All right. Yep. That's what they're doing. George in Jacksonville, Florida, you've got us. Hey, go ahead, George.
Yes, John and George. My grandparents call these people the powers that be. And I worked internationally in the United States for many of these companies associated with these groups you're talking about, and you're absolutely right. I just want to point out two additional things. We have over $4 million dollars worth of gas and oil coming out of that well every day.
Yes.
And it might take 9 to 12 months to cap that thing, looking at what's happened other places in the world. And I suggested to some senators' aides that they go ahead and cut it off 4 feet long. They cut it to a nub, put a valve. They didn't put a valve. And then you drop a standard tank you find on all these platforms called an oil-gas separator. You separate the oil and gas. Then you can get it down the pipelines to the nearest platform and produce it. This can be done within 14 days with the right crew. And this bunch are just nuts. They're really nuts. And the second thing I wanted to bring up is that we have 140 coal-fired power plants, and if we did like South Africa and turned all of that coal into gasoline and sold it to the people like the Chinese, you add biomass into it to get your hydrogen, we could export $1 trillion worth of gasoline a year and pay off our national debt. Now, I still agree with you. We need to cut spending, and we need to go to a fair tax and that type of thing. But there are solutions to every one of these problems these morons have created.
Well, you're right. I don't have enough personal expertise, on the first suggestion, but it sounded real sane to me. The fact that this thing continues to pump has now become a political issue. It's now become a financial boondoggle. If the solution that you suggest works, and it sounds awfully rational to me, the thing could be wrapped up in a couple of weeks. Have you talked to a couple of senator aides about it?
Yes, I've talked to various people behind the scenes because, they've received 80,000 suggestions, and it's very hard to get through. But you have to do things like heat the tank with seawater from above, and you need a compressor and a pump. But we have electric motors on those ROVs that operate 5,000 feet below. I've been told all through my career in industry since the 60s that I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that. I did it anyway. You have to have the attitude you're talking about. We can come back and run this country like the founders did. And there are solutions if you have a positive attitude about it.
I'm with you, George.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it. Rob in Seattle, thanks for holding, Rob. Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, thank you for having me on the show there. Uh-huh. I was just wondering, there's been a lot of people on the radio, even on TV. They have all these wonderful ideas, and they've got wonderful information, and your guest included, and to awaken the minds of the people. But, no one's really offered a simple approach to the people in order for the people to unite in one voice so that the leaders of this country can note. And let these leaders know that it's we the people who are in charge, and that this is our country. We are responsible for ourselves, but maybe we haven't gone that way. It's kind of sad to me that we have all this wonderful information, but there isn't one effective way to unite the people. And I attempted to do that on April 15th of this year, and I had a vision of a black flag with a hole in the center of it. And basically people asked me, I had people from the Marines and the different military that I was an anarchist. And I said, no way. I said, basically what this flag stands for is the light of truth piercing the veil of darkness and deception. And that it's we, the people who see through that veil of deception and venality and tyranny, this veil that our leaders have been placing over our eyes and minds for decades. And people really looked at them. They go, man, that's a great idea. But I wonder for John, is there one way that that you can think of to just simply unite the people and get them together so that we can take back our lives?
Well, Rob, I'm not a politician, and I wouldn't get into politics. But that said, I have done work in Congress, and I have seen the voices of people make a difference in the United States Congress. I have been talking to senators negotiating various legislation on things, and I have seen their aides come in with stacks of faxes and throw them down on the table and say, these people want this bill passed. So this still is a democracy, democracy meaning it's a democratic republic, but what I mean by that is simply that the people's voices can be heard, and I think they're being heard more and more. These elections have pointed out that people are frustrated around the country and that they are making change. The ballot box is a weapon. I don't have, a simple one-shot solution other than to go back to the basics and communicate. And communicate strongly and communicate often let your legislators know. Are you in Washington, did you say?
Yeah, go ahead. He hung up.
Well, listen, this still works. It still works. I remember talking to a congressman about an issue one time, he agreed with what was being said. These were some human rights issues, and he agreed with these, and he was going to vote one way in a bill. And the next day he voted the other way, and I went back and asked his aide what happened. He So, well, we got flooded with phone calls from his district. So this stuff still works, and people need to know that and understand it and not be apathetic about it.
You know, there are some people who still won't believe this. They don't want to believe it. They don't think government would ever do this. They don't think groups or people would ever do this. What do you tell them?
Well, I think that has to do with, what I tell them, George, is to look. I mean, just look with their own eyes and make up their own mind. People have to understand and make their own decisions about their life. Relative to what I'm talking about and what this book is about, it's there for people to see. You don't have to, believe in what I'm saying. You can go look for yourself. You can read the book. You can also just go to the Bank for International Settlements and see the Financial Stability Board. And if you pull the onion, peel the onion enough, and it took me a lot of peeling to get to the bottom of who these guys were and what they were doing, because they conceal it. They conceal it. So not to be self-serving or to sound like a salesman, but I encourage people to read the book and follow the solutions in there, because those are things that can be done to move this existing situation into a better world.
Who is the one Mr. Big in all this? Is there one person?
Well, the guy who comes up on my radar screen the most, George, is George Soros. This guy's a bad actor. One of the callers a little bit ago talked about Soros attacking the Second Amendment. This is also a guy that pushes various, so-called solutions, drugs free for everybody, take away people's guns. And he's got other social policies that are an anathema to this country and to free enterprise and to free individuals. He is the most anti-freedom individual that I've personally run across. If there are other people behind him or along with him, we talked about Zabrinsky. Geithner is clearly one of these guys. I mean, he is a player in this scene. Babyface Tim, but this guy is a player. He is on the board of the Bank for International Settlements, and he is manipulating this economy in ways that are destructive. But if you ask me for a single guy, my vote goes to George Soros.
All right, interesting. All right, next up we go to Clinton, Tennessee. Bob's with us. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, thanks, George.
Sure.
John, I wonder if we can learn from the past. Coincidentally, tonight on public television in Knoxville, 9/11, they had a documentary on Andrew Jackson, 1828-1836. One of his concerns was what he called the U.S. Bank, and he described it just like the Federal Reserve, that it was the rich people taking advantage of the commoners, and he dissolved the bank in around, I think, 1835 or 6. And it took a lot of guts. The Senate and Congress was against him, and somehow he did it. And I'm not enough of a person of history to know how can we learn how he did that. And
well,
thought you'd be interested in that.
Well, Bob, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I had the great honor and privilege to teach American history. Andrew Jackson is one of the great presidents in American history. His fight against the bank, a central bank, is one of the most notable things that he did. You're right, not too many people know about it. He was victorious over it. As George and I pointed out a little bit earlier in the show, President John Kennedy tried to do this a few months before he was shot. The question becomes, are these guys too dug in? I think the answer to that is no. I think there's always a solution. But if you go back and look at what Andrew Jackson did, he just stood his ground. He had enough political allies, and this is a political war. Let's not kid ourselves. He had enough political allies and worked his friends and his enemies, and he came out victorious. So it can be done.
Next up, we go to – thanks, Bob. Let's go to Earl in Minnesota. Go ahead, Earl.
Hi, thank you, guys. Thanks for taking my call, and,
sure,
and thank you both for what you do. I just got a quick question. I've been looking at this stuff for a couple of years, and I'm just wondering if any of your material you cover, like the Cistus Trust and Cistus and the Cistecue Trust, and do you explain the difference between a Federal Reserve note and a banknote in any of your books or information?
I don't do that, but it's a good point, and I'm not and I don't get into that trust either. But the Federal Reserve note is just a piece of paper printed by the Federal Reserve Bank, and as I was saying to an earlier caller, which it sounds like you know, they just print this stuff out of thin air. It costs it costs 3 cents to print a $100 bill, and they charge interest on the 100, not on the 3 cents.
Right, exactly. And so, for instance, I know that when you go, you know, you sign for your house. I mean, it's like, you know, we the people, we actually create the credit that they use.
Yes, we do. You're absolutely right.
And so, like, for instance, I heard an account where a guy was losing his house, and he, you know, went to the, you know, court with the bank, and he actually, you know, in his legal paperwork, he made him bring forth the title, and the title said it was already satisfied, and he actually got his house back.
Well, good for him.
I mean, it's just, you know, there's just lots of tricks, I guess. I don't mean to throw you a curve or anything, but I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Thank you for the call.
Just a few minutes to go. Get the name of the book and the website out one more time, John, then we'll take final calls.
Again, folks, the book is Crisis by Design, The Untold Story of the Global Financial Coup. The website is behindthewizardscurtain.com, behindthewizardscurtain.com.
Okay, let's go back to final calls now. We'll go to Robert, first-time caller in California. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Okay.
Squeeze you in here.
Oh, thank you. Yes, John, aren't what these international bankers are doing illegal, and the way the Federal Reserve is operating illegal as well? Why couldn't we expect the CIA and FBI, if they were doing their jobs, to bring these guys under control and under the law?
Well, it's an interesting question. In the book, you'll find in one of the chapters there, something that I stumbled on, which I didn't know as I was writing the book, because I was researching the SDR, this international currency that the International Monetary Fund puts out. And this currency has basically been sleeping for 40 years. It was created in 1969. What I stumbled across was a secret memo.
30 seconds, Joe.
A secret memo by the CIA that created the SDR, and a copy of that memo is in the book.
All right, my friend, I want to thank you for really a compelling discussion with you tonight.
Well, George, it's an honor to be on your show. I'm glad you found it, refreshing, as did I. I mean, I love talking about it.
We're going to put you in one of the what I call resource categories in case we need you for breaking stories, too.
I'll look forward to doing it, George.
All right, and good luck with the documentary.
Thanks so much.
John Truman Wolf, author of Crisis by Design, The Untold Story of the Global Financial Coup. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Pundit and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.